Okay, so let's see, where's the best place to start this? Well, the best place to start this is with the Buddha. So the Buddha was very practical kind of a teacher, and didn't really too much favor conversations about metaphysics. He favored being very practical about what's on people's minds and what's of really of concern to them. But usually talks about Buddhism start with something like life is unsatisfactory and then proceed from there. I mean, that's the way traditionally Buddhist talks start. But the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and what he needed, people are in some respects the same and in some respects different. So Americans are pretty different than people of India 2,500 years ago, although some things are the same. We're all born, we all live, we all die. Those things are the same, but other things are different. Buddha lived in a time where there was no writing. He was not literate because nobody was literate. They had an oral tradition. People had good memories. But that also means that they had really different kinds of minds, because they didn't have minds that were formed by being in a literate tradition. They didn't think about things in the way in which we do, because the tradition was so different. So if this were a university class, I would start with, so the Buddha said that life is unsatisfactory and sort of went from there, but it's not, so I won't. So for Americans in the 21st century, I think a better place to start is with me, I, because everybody in this room is of the deep opinion that they're the center of the universe. Every single one of us. It comes natural to us. I mean, that's not to put anybody down, but all of us think we're the center of the universe. And there are one, two, three, four, five, six, 14 of us in this room. Now, by some mathematical points of view, I suppose that the universe could have at least 14 centers. And how many billion people are on the planet right now? So there are that many billion centers to the universe on this one planet. And that's only counting the people, because from the Buddhist point of view, all animals, all living things, actually have this same sense of being I. And I is the point which is the center of the universe. And every animal is primarily concerned about itself. That is, doesn't mean that animals aren't altruistic, and it doesn't mean that humans aren't altruistic. But on a moment-by-moment basis, we know that basically what we all do is have these little narratives and dramas going on. We can hear them in our head about me. So that's a good place to start, you know, because that's what we care the most about. And that's okay. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. It's actually just what is. And Buddhism being sort of a practical approach to being alive and dealing with being alive, it's like, so you start with what is, and what is I. But the problem with I is we think we know what I is until something happens and we're not so sure anymore. And then there are these problems with I, besides the fact that there are 4 billion I's, all of whom think they're the center of the universe, which would suggest there is a problem someplace, at least conceptually, that unless the universe has 4 billion centers on planet Earth, there is definitely something erroneous to that point of view. And we know what kind of problems that creates. All you have to do is go to a committee meeting at the university and have a half a dozen centers of the universe who are quite sure that what they want to do and their viewpoints are the correct viewpoints, and you see where that leads us. And that would work if, you know, if we're at the hospital, the high school. It doesn't really make any difference. It's all the same thing that's going on. So I is a fact, but I is also a problem. And you know, for Americans in particular, I is a very interesting kind of problem, because we not only think that we're the center of the universe, we think we're entitled to be the center of the universe, and the only thing that really is mysterious is how come everybody else doesn't notice that we're the center of the universe. Because we are, and that's the way that everyone should be treating us, obviously. And of course, you know, I mean, if you think about it, the problem with that is there's one of you and there's 4 billion other centers of the universe, and they don't seem to want to treat you the way you want to be treated. And so from that point of view, we do get to the Buddhist idea that there's something unsatisfactory about things. Not necessarily that there's something unsatisfactory about life, but there's something unsatisfactory about this notion that I'm the center of the universe, even though it's obviously moment by moment completely true. All I have to do is look, and it's clear that I'm the center of everything. So that's an interesting place to start from, because, as the Dalai Lama says, if what you want is to be happy, which all the eyes in the center of the universe would agree that they would like to be happy, if what you want is to be happy, and the way you go about becoming happy and the premises that you have that lead you into various kinds of behaviors that would make you happy are fundamentally flawed, it seems pretty reasonable that you're not going to end up achieving the happiness that you want. It's kind of like, I don't know, I can't think of a metaphor for this at the moment. Maybe it's so obvious it doesn't require a metaphor, and we'll just sort of leave it at that. So actually, this is very much in line with basic Buddhist teaching. So we all want to be happy, and somehow it's not working, and why is that, and what can we do about it? And so one place to begin is that this I is the problem. Not that we have an I, because we're never going to get rid of the I, but that there's something problematic in the way we think about the I and we relate to our own I. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. When we talk about I, we always think we know what we're talking about, because here I am. But when we actually turn our minds to looking at I, then we have a little bit more of a problem. I mean, for example, if it's December and I'm driving to Pendleton on an icy road, and I'm up in the area of Meacham, and my car decides to start going 90 degrees horizontally toward the guardrail, I really appears to be my body. There's no question about the fact that I is my body in that particular moment. Now, 5 minutes before that, I might have been the person who was thinking about the committee meeting I was in the previous day where I got dissed by somebody else. And that's the reason why I missed that patch of ice and my car is sliding toward a guardrail. But before I hit that patch of ice, I was in another place, in another time, and I wasn't my body. I was the role of this person in this committee meeting. And when I was in the committee meeting, I wasn't even thinking about my body. What I was thinking about was probably something like, I'm right and you're wrong. Well, but that has nothing to do with your body. Bodies aren't right or wrong, okay? I mean, bodies just are. So, okay, so one moment, my I is associated with right, wrong, still the center of the universe, though. And the next moment, I is associated with my body, you know, sliding toward a guardrail, still the center of the universe, until I hit the guardrail. And then I have something else to worry about, which is one of the things I know about I is that I don't know about whether or not I had a beginning, because I can't remember it, but I'm sure worried about I having an end, especially in that situation. Now, so that's an interesting problem, too. That I doesn't seem to have a beginning, but I'm really worried about it having an end. But I don't really know if it has an end or not. Now, I've been around some folks who are dying, and I've been around some dead bodies, and mostly my parents, actually, which is a special kind of dead body, of course. And, you know, when they were dying, they were really worried about what happens to I. Even as miserable as they were still worried about it. My mother was 97 when she died, and she, at 97, went, I think, 21 days without food or water before she died. That's somebody whose eye really held on. Mm-hmm.
or held on to their eye or something. Something was going on. She didn't want to let go, even though she was really not happy. So there's this thing about I, you know, and we don't really know what it is. And that's the thing that's quite amazing. You know, although we're completely connected to it, and it's a real important thing to us, is the maybe the dearest thing to us, when we really start looking closely at it or wondering about it, it starts getting really mysterious. Like, where is it? What is it? And so on and so forth. So the Buddhists focused on this a lot. And without really belaboring this point too much, the thing that we've been talking about up to now a lot, the five aggregates, or the five skandhas of the Sanskrit, was one of the ways in which the Buddha raised the question of, okay, well, let's go looking for this I, and what do we know about it? And based upon that, maybe we can have a better experience of being the center of the universe, and maybe the universe will start treating us in whatever way it would treat the center of the universe. Of course, the Buddha was very clever. He knew when he went through this whole routine what everyone was going to discover was, no, there are 4 billion centers of the universe, or however many people there were. In fact, even the person he was talking to wasn't the center of the universe. Anyhow, the way he went through the process was saying, you know, what do we know for sure? Well, we know for sure we have a body, you know. And we know for sure that we have things that we're attracted to and repelled by, and that those are two categories of experience that are very different. And we know we have perceptions, that we experience things, which is different than having a body. And he went on like this. And so, anyway, he articulated five categories that were worth looking at and seeing how the phenomena or the experiences associated with those five categories related to each other. And what the five were the body, the fact that in every single moment we are attracted to or repelled by something, or we feel neutral, but we always have feelings about things. When we're feeling neutral, it's usually, Americans call it boredom. And it's something, though, that's generally viewed as repellent. So it's sort of neutral is more like negative for most Americans. I kind of like neutral myself, but I'm a little strange. So we have bodies, and we know that we have attraction and repulsion to just about everything in any given moment. And we know that most of our experience is made up of perception, because we know we have senses, and if we pay attention to what's going on, we realize that the world that we experience is not really a whole. You know, we actually realize that there are things that we see, things that we hear, things that we touch, smell, taste. And from the Buddhist point of view, although I don't want to get sidetracked on this right now, there are things that we think about, because the Buddhists consider what we call thinking, which is internal verbal dialogue, they actually consider it the perception of ideas. They don't consider it thinking in the way in which we say thinking, as in I am producing thoughts. Their view is that what's going on is there's awareness of thoughts, but it's not necessarily that I am producing thoughts, which is a really interesting distinction. It's because it begins to get at the issue of how it's possible to look differently at this I, and how do most people think about the I. Okay, so there's that. Then there was another category of experience, which is all the habits that we have, which determine what we're attracted to, repelled by, and the way we shape perception and what we think about. And those things are, they come from our previous experience, they come from the way we're educated, they come from our language, in fact. You know, English predisposes us to perceive in certain ways. And so from the Buddhist point of view, the impact of the structure of the English language is it creates habits of perception, because we're used to an agent, subject, acting, verb, upon something in some way. But every language in the world is not necessarily like that. And in fact, many languages predispose people to experience reality differently. But they're predisposed to experience reality in some way. So there's a difference, presumably, between how they experience reality and what's real. Because just like there can't be 4 billion centers of the universe, it doesn't really make any sense that the reality of English speakers is somehow truer to reality than the reality of Chinese speakers. I mean, it's possible, but it's equally likely that everyone's equally deluded rather than one group is more enlightened than the other. And that makes for a much more equitable world anyway, even if it's not true. Because it would be really a drag if a billion Chinese said, Chinese is the only way to understand reality and the rest of you don't know anything. They may say that eventually anyway, I don't know. But it would not be a very good thing. The last thing we know is that we're aware. And we're conscious. And there's something about consciousness and awareness which seems really special, but also very mysterious. There's a program. There's a series of lectures that you can find on the internet called the TED Talks, TED. Mm-hmm. Really great technology, education, and design is what TED stands for. They're free. I don't know who is funding these things. They get all these extraordinary people that show up and do these short talks. And then they're all archived, and I really love to stretch out in bed with my iPad and put it on my lap, unlike what I used to do with a book, though exactly what I used to do with a book, and watch the TED Talks and listen to them. Mm. Well, there was a TED Talk recently. I want to say a young woman, but she probably was in her early 30s, so that says something about me rather than her, which actually says a lot about a lot, since we're talking about the I. And delusions. Anyway, she seemed like a young woman to me. And she was talking about cognitive processes, and in particular about children, and had some really interesting things to say. And she was also talking about moral development and a presumably a moral center of the brain that could be changed in certain ways. And so the moderator had some questions for her and was very interesting with his questions. And then finally said, so this is really interesting because it really speaks to the way in which consciousness can be impacted by these kind of processes that you're talking about, which are magnetic processes, which actually can change the way you think. I won't go into it in any detail because they don't understand it particularly. Anyway, but she was changing moral judgments based upon creating sort of electromagnetic fields with big magnets. Very interesting. So the moderator says, so what do you think are the implications of this for our understanding consciousness? Do you think that we'll finally understand consciousness in this century, or in your lifetime rather, not in this century, in your lifetime? And she looked at him, and I don't know, some MIT neuropsychologist or something like that. And she said, no. Mm-hmm. And he was taken aback, and he said, so why not? And she said, they don't call it the hard problem of consciousness for nothing. That was all she had to say. So, I mean, even, you know, like an advanced neuroscientist who was featured on the TED Talks, very brilliant young lady, basically said, no, I don't think we're going to figure it out in my lifetime. There's something difficult and mysterious about it. Okay, and yet, we're all sure we know what it is and that we've got it, and it's what places us at the center of the universe. If it wasn't our body, then it's the consciousness in our body that puts us at the center of the universe, and that's a natural fact, and we know it perfectly well. Until we really, again, start looking at this stuff closely, as in, what happens when I fall asleep? Which is always kind of mysterious because it's not there and nothing is there. And then I wake up in the morning and not only is it there, but a lot of stuff is there, including my aching back and, you know, whatever. But it comes and it goes, and it's something we think we understand because we are very close to it. And yet, like the eye, when we look at it really closely, we realize how little we actually understand about it. I mean, so this is 2011, and when did Sigmund Freud publish his book on dreams? Was it 1905? Mm-hmm. Or was it 1895? Something like that, around the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. I hate it that I can't remember something as classic as that. So something about consciousness and old bodies, right? Brains, right? Okay. So anyway, so, you know, what Sigmund did was he shocked people. And the reason Freud shocked people was he said, you have an unconscious mind. Well, what does that mean? How can you have an unconscious mind?
Well, what he meant was there's stuff going on in your, quote, mind, whatever that means, that you're not aware of, whatever that means, which impacts everything about what you're doing. And people said, what? How can, you know? But it's, you know, pretty much accepted right now. I mean, however you think about these things, it's pretty much accepted that there's stuff going on somehow inside of us, someplace, that has some impact on us in ways which we don't understand, that makes us do, think, be in ways that are unexpected. Like, you know, doing dumb stuff, for example, like having a meeting with your boss and saying the very thing that you don't want to say and that you knew you didn't want to say, and then you said it. And it's kind of like, why did I say that? Now, we've all had an experience like that, or, you know, it's kind of like, where did that come from? Well, Sigmund has the answer to that question. He called it something going on in the unconscious. Well, we may not be Freudians, but we know there's stuff going on that's impacting what we're doing, and we don't understand it. Yet, we think we know everything about our own consciousness. It's kind of like everybody, and one of the things we're sure of is everybody else has an unconsciousness, which is affecting everything they're doing except me. I don't have one. I don't have any unconscious processes doing dumb stuff. Only the other 4 billion people on the planet, who, by the way, aren't the center of the universe, they have an unconscious. Don't we all believe it? Yeah, of course we all believe it. Okay. So it suggests that there's some problems here. So this is the kind of stuff that the Buddha was focusing on. So, all right. In a certain way, that brings us all onto the same page in terms of some of the stuff we've been talking about in the past. So, on that basis, what I want to do is I want to ask this question then, which is, when we say I, and we're aware of I, at first blush, when we talk about that experience, the way we understand it and the way we think it's happening is, I am aware. I, as the center of the universe, am aware of the other 13 of you who are not the center of the universe. I'm aware of you. Like, I is the agent that's aware of you. Now, the Buddha would encourage us to reflect on that in a very interesting way. He would encourage us to look at that statement and look at that experience and observe that I'm aware. Now, English is going to trip us up here, so pardon me for being tripped up. But we would observe awareness of I. Now, we think that I am aware, but we would notice I being aware, which means we're aware of I. So doesn't that suggest something's backwards? Doesn't it suggest that it's not I that's aware of the world, but there's awareness which includes I? So right away, that would tell us that the center of the universe can't be I, because the center of the universe, who is the point of reference that's aware of I, is aware of I. That I, this, is an object, not a subject, and that the subject is awareness. So right off the bat, as soon as we reflect on this, we recognize that moment by moment, 24/7, we got it backwards all the time, unless we're reflecting on what we're doing. We've got it backwards, because moment by moment, it's, I am aware of this. But the tricky thing is, as soon as someone calls your attention to this fact, because we're all intelligent, educated people, immediately we get, no. I is as much an object of the awareness. So what's the subject then? The awareness. Uh-oh, now we have a new problem, right? Because now we have awareness or consciousness, which is the actual subject. How is that possible? And how is it possible that we're aware that we're aware? Okay. That becomes a new problem, because we are aware that we're aware. So how is this possible? Well, okay. The reason that Buddhists, among others, practice meditation is to solve that problem. Because we've tried to talk about this in the past, right, at some of these events, and we know we can't. Right? That language fails us
when we try and use it to get at the problem of what's the actual subject that's aware of what was the presumed subject that went through a moment by moment thinking it was a subject until we discovered it was actually an object. And I'm sorry, that was, I'm sure, totally confusing. But I think, you know, based upon what I said earlier, I think we understand what we're talking about. So moment by moment, there is this possibility that if we choose to look at our experience differently, we might have a chance of finding out what our experience actually is. And what choice do we have? I mean, what's the alternative? Now, I think most people don't actually care, to be totally honest with you. Most people simply don't care, and that's fine. I mean, I spent a lot of time with a Swami of a different tradition, not a Buddhist, who lived in Albany at the time. And he said, you know, it would be a whole lot simpler if all of us were just completely satisfied to go to our jobs, come home, you know, drink a couple cans of beer and go to sleep and not worry about it. However, nobody in this room is like that. So now we all are stuck and that's not going to work for us. So that's like nobody in this room is, it's not going to work for anybody in this room or you wouldn't be here, right? If it worked for you, you wouldn't be here. So that one isn't going to work for you, right? You know? I mean, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with drinking a few cans of beer.
Some days.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Kay knows that if she goes grocery shopping and she doesn't come home with a bottle or two of wine, there's a problem. So I understand that. But fundamentally, it still doesn't solve the problem. It might work for a couple of hours, but the next morning, the problem's back again. Okay. So, anyhow, the point of all of this, and humor is good, but humor aside, the point of all of this is that what Buddhists teach about meditation really is about finding a way to get a better idea of what the heck is actually going on with the I and with consciousness and with the 4 billion centers of the universe and why things sort of work. I mean, we're all basically doing all right in this life. Everybody in this room is basically doing all right in this life. But everybody in this room is also probably thinking about things like, yeah, but this life isn't going to go on for a real long time. When my dad died at 86 during the last couple of weeks of his life, one of the things he said was, it went by so fast. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody says that. I've been in Le Grand for 7 years now. I find that is astonishing. It just does not seem like 7 years. I mean, in 7 years, you can get an undergraduate degree and a law degree, right? But 7 years, bang, just like that, okay? So I'm sure that I'll be whatever age I am, and I'll say it went by so fast, you know? So we know this already, right? So there's some way in which we want to deal with some of these questions. So meditation is one of the ways of looking at this. You know, meditation is not about some kind of dogma. Meditation is not a mere technique, although it is a technique. Meditation, at least as taught in the Buddhist tradition, is an empirical process for studying oneself. Now, it has some unusual twists to it. For example, in the Tibetan tradition, one of the unusual twists is you do things like, say, what do we know about the I, that the I is associated with an image that I have of myself? Okay, I mean, we all understand that. You know, I have an image of David. You know, when I think of David, you know, I see this good-looking 25-year-old guy. I don't see this 65-year-old. I don't see this 65-year-old wreck. I see the guy with the waist size that's still 31 inches rather than 38 inches, and so on and so forth, right? Okay. It's actually true, in fact. The self, but the point is that I is associated with a self-image, and in order to learn about the way in which I is associated with a self-image, Buddhists invite you to associate the I with a different self-image and find out what happens. Because then you learn about the way in which I is associated with a self-image. And you also learn about what happens if you change the self-image.
Now, it's not because imagining yourself with a bump on the top of your head with long ears and wearing silk robes and jewels is somehow a great thing. Oh, and by the way, you're made of light instead of matter. It's not because that in itself is a great thing, although, I don't know, I think it might be a pretty good thing. I'm sure that if I was made of light, I wouldn't have arthritis, and that would be okay with me. But the point is, you can discover that you can feel I in relationship with that image, almost, at least in the moment of meditation, almost as clearly as you can feel I in relationship with your physical body. And when you notice that, then you start noticing different things about I and the I process. So this is all about an experiment to understand what's going on inside and also to understand how consciousness relates to all of this. So we will be doing some of those experiments here, and the whole point of doing those experiments is to learn about oneself. And the whole point of learning about oneself is to figure out, if I'm not really the center of the universe, which we all agree now, we're probably not, what am I and where am I and how do I fit into the universe and how do I fit in with relationship with everybody else? Now, one of the things that I said that we would talk about this year because it was requested was to talk about altruism and the cultivation of altruism, the cultivation of one's relationship with others. But to do that, you have to start with oneself, I, that's in relationship with the others. Because other and I is really the same thing, right? My relationship with the 13 of you is a matter of I. It's just that 13 of those I's are you and one of those I's is me, except for the I that's you, which is you. And then I'm the other. And that's the reality that we live with. So to work with that, we also have to understand the I process that's going on inside of everybody. And when we have a better feel for that, then we have a better feel for how we can have different kinds of relationships with each other, which is, I think, mostly what people want to have, is different kinds of relationships with each other. For example, and this is where I'll close things, what I've been doing in my work, the most important thing that I do in my work at the university is not what the university pays me to do. The university pays me to be a geek, and I do it very well. But from my point of view, the most important thing I do is I practice friendliness every single day, every single moment. Now, that makes me a much better geek because one of my jobs is picking up the phone when somebody says, "Eek, my computer isn't doing what I want it to do." You know, and okay, I've heard this particular problem in the last 3 years probably about 300 times, and now it's the 301st time. How do I give that person what they want with all the sweetness that they need to get when they're just pissed off at their damn computer or Blackboard or whatever it is? Now, I'm not saying I succeed at it all the time, but that's my practice. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it really is what the university is paying me to do, because they could hire any fool to answer that question, but how long would they last? And what would be happening in the institution if they snarled at you instead of just nicely answering your question? So for all of us, there's some version of that which matters, whether it's with a spouse, coworker, grocery store clerk, doesn't really make any difference. We all deal with that. So that's where I'll leave things for the moment, and we'll take a break. And or do we put, let's do, all right, let's do question and answer, and then we'll take a break, and then Kay will do a meditation, which is to say we'll start experimenting, and we'll continue to do these different experiments. And in 2 weeks, I'll talk some more about the center of the universe or whatever I talk about. Okay. Questions? Or would you rather eat cheesecake? How hard is that?
I guess I was thinking about, you were talking about focusing on an image to replace the eye, which I wasn't aware of that. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I'm not sure.
How would that work?
Yeah.
Do you want me to, or do you want to do that, Kay?
Go ahead.
How would that work?
Yeah. Please.
Okay. if you think about I in relationship to your experience, I in relationship to your body, I in relationship to what you're attracted to or repelled by, the Buddhist view on this is that I in that situation is an idea. It's not like I is a little person inside of you, which is, I mean, the technical term for this is homunculus, a little person inside of you. It's not like there's a little person inside of you that is the I that's somehow running this robot or something, but rather there is this idea of me that is connected with a self-image, and that is sort of plastered over your experience. That's why I was joking about I as having a 31-inch waistline and being 25 years old, because my self-image of who I am is not this. It's simply, you know, it's not a guy who wears a size large. It really isn't. You know, it really isn't. I mean, you know, at core, I have an image of myself which actually I'm projecting on what's here, and we're all the same. You know, we're all the same. Every one of us. Okay, so that sense of the relationship of the I and the image that is projected onto or covers over experience, you can play with that. And you can play with the idea of I in relationship to a self-image that is, say, a great golfer or a great skier. I mean, it's one of the ways in which we develop certain skills. We imagine ourselves doing something and enacting something. Or we can imagine ourselves, if we're parents, for example, having a different kind of conversation with our children than we typically have, because we want to be more patient with them or more loving toward them when they're yowling or being a pain in the ass or something like that. It's kind of like, no, I don't want to be the reactive parent, you know, because I understand why they're unhappy. So I imagine myself being a certain way in relationship to them. So you actually imagine yourself being differently in those situations. So you can play with that, and you can imagine yourself being the image of compassionate. You can imagine yourself being the image of wise. Now, why certain images you might adopt, like putting on certain kinds of clothes, is a little bit complicated, and maybe I can get to it the next time we meet. But maybe that's a good metaphor, you know. It's fall. When winter comes, I'm going to put on a down coat when I go outside because the weather requires a down coat when I go outside. And I'm going to put on a hat because my hair is long since gone. And, you know, so I have to, you know. So I see myself doing these things and putting on these clothes. So you can see yourself putting on a certain image to accomplish a certain objective. You can see yourself putting on the image of patience to accomplish a certain objective. Now, why the image of patience would look a certain way, now that's pretty complicated. And I'm not going to be able to answer that question right now.
Yeah, I
go ahead, Kay.
One thing here. There are many levels of reality to who we are. And if you know something a little bit about quantum physics, you know, and the perception of the fact that we're made out of, you know, light, and that we're made out of, you know, these atoms that are constantly moving and changing and so on and so forth, you know, that's not something that we normally perceive ourselves as. We perceive ourselves as something that is solid, mm-hmm. and that it's independent and so on and so forth down the Buddhist line, when in reality we're made of light, we're constantly changing, we're interdependent with all things, mm-hmm. you know, that energy crosses over. Mm-hmm. So there's many fixed ideas about what this is, you know, that is erroneous. And here's, you know, Buddhism comes forward, you know, 2,500 years ago and is having you imagine yourself as a body of light and using light to actually affect that. And using a body of light to say, well, maybe I'm this, but I'm also this. You know, I'm also this body of life that's also changing. And because of that, you become much more flexible and malleable. And so it helps, it can help with healing. So like if you have, for example, if you have a very fixed, you have something wrong with your lungs. You have a very fixed idea that my lungs are something that's solid, they're inside, I don't really know quite what they are. They're, you know, I know that somehow they help me breathe. Sometimes I can't breathe because I'm asthmatic or something like that. Well, then if you start thinking about this as a living system and that it's something that can change and it's malleable, it is made of these atoms that interact with each other and are made of light. And when the oxygen comes in, there's a reaction. And you can also think about the fact that when there are things that are harmful that come in, and you can start actually working with that through visualization, or like cancers or all sorts of things like that too. You can, you know, that's kind of common in our current reality, that they're using mindfulness or meditations and visualization with working with heart patients and cancer and so forth. But it's the same idea, you know. So when we do, when we visualize ourselves as Shakyamuni Buddha or Aryatara or Vajrasattva, these beings that are made out of light and have these certain proportions, it's like this idealized sacred proportion that has come down through the experience of meditators that have perceived this over the centuries, and that understand that if we see ourselves like this, that it can bring healing on all sorts of levels, not just our physical level, our ideas about ourselves, and, you know, so on and so forth. So our emotional body, everything.
Let me make an observation about the power of mind, which is really what she's talking about. It was one of the things I was thinking about talking about this evening, but didn't really quite get around to getting at. Moment by moment, as we go through our day, we experience this physical world around us. But if we stop and think about it, just like stopping to think about the eye, what we realize is that when I see something, we know that what the experience is my mind or my consciousness and my eye somehow have produced an image of something in my cognitive process. We may not know the details of it, but all of us know enough about psychology to understand that what we experience is not really the physical world. We convince ourselves we're experiencing the physical world. What we're experiencing is a representation of the world. It's very inconvenient for us to moment by moment think this is a representation of the world rather than this is the world. But we can do that. And I think it probably makes us uncomfortable to start doing this very much. But you can actually get to this place of thinking moment by moment, this is a representation. This is a mental representation of a world that's there. You know, I mean, the Buddhists don't deny that there's a physical world out there. They simply say that what you're experiencing is a representation of it, whether it's a visual, an auditory, a tactile, in fact, all of those things coming together, which means actually, moment by moment, what you're experiencing is your own mind. You don't actually experience the world. Now, that makes most people really pretty damn nervous, but it is the truth. You know, I mean, the representation, hopefully, is a good representation of the world. But, I mean, it isn't always a good representation of the world, and we know that, because we'll find ourselves in situations where we think, oh, I'm in a committee meeting with somebody, and they're dissing me, right? But then I have a conversation with them afterwards, and it's like, they don't have anything against me. You know, we're perfectly friendly. There was some idea I had that they didn't like. I thought they were dissing me, okay? So what happened? My representation of what was going on in that meeting bore no relationship at all with what was happening. And if I hadn't had a conversation with this person to get it straightened out, it would have led to all kinds of negative consequences down the line. I would have thought, hey, this person's an enemy of mine. No, they just didn't like my idea. They liked me perfectly well. They just didn't like my idea. And that's reasonable. Why should they always like my ideas? Okay, so what we're experiencing moment by moment is our own mental representation. So what Kay is talking about is what happens when you start playing with the mental representation in some way. That's really the issue. You know, I'm talking about the I as the primary mental representation that's an issue. But the main thing is that we experience 24/7 this narrative of mental representations, which is problematic. But we can change the narrative. And since the narrative always has actors in it doing things, if we change the actors, then the narrative changes. So who are the actors that we'd like to be? Well, Shakyamuni is a really nice actor because he actually knows what's going on, unlike me. So if I imagine myself being him, maybe there's some way in which something will be different. Now, next week, next time we meet, I'll talk more about the Buddhist views of levels of consciousness from coarse to subtle and how all of our different consciousnesses interact and relate to each other. I can't really do that now. We go on forever. But in 2 weeks, I will. And then that will explain much more fully why it is that, because it can be explained, why it is that imagining myself as Shakyamuni Buddha actually does good things. Because I actually have a relationship with Buddha, even though he's been, quote, dead for 2,500 years. I have a relationship with my guru, my lama, who is alive. He just happens to be on the other side of the world right now. And given that it's 7:30 in the morning, he's probably doing his prayers, knowing who he is and what he does. But he may be on the other side of the world right now, but my consciousness and his have a relationship with each other now. And you can, through these kinds of experiments that we're talking about, you can kind of see how this is and experience it. You just have to take that on, quote, faith for the moment. That's a real bad word, and Buddhists really don't like it, as a matter of fact. But for the moment, until I can, you know, give me 2 weeks, okay? Take it on faith for 2 weeks, and then I'll give it to you logically, and then you can experiment and decide I'm full of it or not. Okay, so, all right, let's leave it at that. Unless there are more questions. That's a start for your answer. But you asked a difficult one.
Okay. Is mental representation the same as perception, if we said the word perception?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because that's what a perception is. You know, when I say I see Kayla, I say I see Kayla, but what I've done is I've visually constructed an image of Kayla. That's the mental representation. Yes, exactly. And that we understand perception is that perception exists is the reason that we can understand mental representation. Imagine, suppose you couldn't close your eyes. Suppose your eyes are like your ears. Right? You can't make sound stop. But you can close your eyes, and because you can close your eyes, you understand that you can make the visual world disappear. So that's, I mean, cognitively incredibly powerful, you know. We know we can make the visual world disappear by closing our eyes. Therefore, we know we construct it, because it's not there unless we open our eyes. And we can't do that with any other sense, which is really very interesting. I've always found that very, very interesting. It's a funny blessing, in a way, that we can do that. I wish I could close my ears, believe me. There's so much bad music in this neighborhood. And barking dogs. And, you know, heat pumps and everything else. I really wish I could just...
Yeah, but silence.
Oh, I'd love it. I would love it. Yeah. More questions, or shall we have some cheesecake? Okay, I'm talked out. That's good.
So I'll have tea and cheesecake.